Well, good morning. Hey, God is doing so many cool things in our city. I'm just going to ask you guys to pray for one thing. This Thursday morning, a group of 10 pastors from Greater Austin are going to be meeting together with the superintendents of three school districts in our community and also with a foundation that works to help the school districts do a better job with education. And this is going to be a great meeting. The faith community is really not interfaced a whole lot in this direct way with our school districts. And so the pastors that are part of these churches represent about 45,000 believers in Austin. And when I told the school leadership that we represented that many people, they started salivating. I mean, possibly the Christians would turn out in mass to try to help children learn how to read and write and move forward in their character and grow, that could be a game changer for our city. And that's what Jesus came to be, as a game changer. So just pray for that meeting, that God would do whatever he wanted to do in that meeting, and we'd see God move forward. The second thing I'd like you to do is something I'd like you to do right now. I want you to do something actually really gutsy, okay? Can I ask you to do something really bold and brave? And that is, I'm going to ask you to pray for 20 seconds, okay? And what I want you to pray is simply this: God, speak clearly to me this morning through your word, okay? If you have enough boldness and courage to do that, let's do it right now, okay? Let's bow our heads, pray. Amen. Now, how many of you believe that that prayer is going to get answered in the next few minutes, okay? Whole bunch of you. So this could be a game-changing Sunday for you, right? Could be a game-changing Sunday. Well, open your Bibles to Psalm 40. We're going to dive into the Psalm. We've been looking for this year at this theme, connecting with the life of God. And I know a lot of us, we tend to look at God from the perspective that he doesn't really have a life. Not that he's bored and doesn't have a life. I mean, that he doesn't have a life in the sense that we tend to boil God down to an idea or a theology or a set of beliefs. Sometimes we boil God down to spaces, like with inside of a building like this, and we don't think about God as someone who is alive, a being that thinks, that decides, that feels, a being that loves, that hates, a being that creates, a being that designs, a being that walks with people and interacts with people. And when we boil God down to simply something ethereal, something that we can set aside, then we end up living our lives relationally void of God. And there are lots of us who would say, yeah, I believe the Bible is true. I believe that Jesus died for my sins. I believe that I'm going to spend eternity with the Father. But practically speaking, tomorrow, when you get up to go about whatever you're going to do, the idea that God is with you and he's personally interacting with you is something that's really foreign to your experience. And so this year we're looking at how that works. And the Psalms are a good place for us to understand this, because the Psalms are songs that were written by people who had a connection with God, the experience with God in some way, and they wrote about it. And the thing that we love about the Psalms is they didn't hold anything back. They let it all hang out. If they were upset, they spoke about their pain. If they were depressed, they spoke about their depression. If things were going wrong, they spoke about what was going wrong. And if things were going right, they spoke about what was going right, and did that with God. And so what happens when our experience collides with our view of what we think God is and who we think he is? And that's where the Psalms are. Now, last week we started out with the individual lament psalm. In Psalm 13, where David is having a major problem, and he has given what for to God. He starts out with, how long, God? He says it four times. How long are you going to do this? You're going to let me sit here and not pay attention to me, and I'm losing this battle, whatever it is, possibly with his physical health, and you're not doing anything about it. And we saw that through David's experience of actually being open and vulnerable, laying his feelings out before God, that God began to change him. And in the course of that, God drew him deeply into prayer and then deeply into a reminder of how much God loved him. And even though the psalm did not get resolved, or the situation didn't get resolved, David began to change in the middle of his pain. Now, that particular psalm went from what we would consider bad to good. Psalm 40 is exactly the opposite. It goes from what appears to be good to bad. And I picked these two psalms because I want you to understand. Sometimes you go from the pit to the mountaintop. Sometimes you go from the mountaintop to the pit. And God's in both places, okay? So let's look at the psalm together. Psalm 40 starts out with this whole idea that waiting on God is oftentimes rewarded. We see the reward in the first 10 verses. So as they wait on God, as David waits on God, connects with God's life, oftentimes that waiting is rewarded. And that's our first concept or first principle from the first 10 verses. Look at what he says in verse 1. He says, I waited patiently for the Lord. So I'm in a bad situation. Life is falling apart. Things are wrong. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and the mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. So what David is saying is that I was in a really bad situation, and he compares it to being trapped in a cistern. Now, today we drill wells or we tap into the city lines and we get our water that way. In the ancient world, and particularly in the area where David grew up, it's a pretty arid country. And so when it rains, you capture as much water as you can. And what they would do is they would hew out the limestone. They would create a big deep pit and cut the limestone. But the limestone has cracks in it. And so if you filled that up with water, it would eventually leak out. So they took mud, much like people who are building ponds in Central Texas do. They took mud and they would pack that mud in there and they would line it. And when the water got in there, it would cause that mud to get saturated and it would form a liner in the cistern. Well, that was all good and fine. So when the rain came, the cistern would fill up and they'd have water for a while. But if it didn't rain for a long time and they used the water, eventually it would get down to the bottom. And what you'd have in the bottom is a little bit of water, a lot of mud, and if anybody fell into it, it was impossible to get out. Can you imagine? Like you're in the bottom of a pit, you're looking up at the top, you try to climb up the side, it's all this mud, slime, you're stuck. And here's what David is saying. I'm in a situation, God, where I can't do anything to rescue myself. I can't get out of it. We don't know what the situation was, whether he was losing a battle in a military setting, whether David was losing a relational conflict where he was misunderstood. We don't know what the issue, whether it was a health issue, but David was saying, I came to a point where I was stuck and I couldn't get out. And so I waited, and I waited, and I prayed, and I waited, and I prayed, and God, you came in, and you rescued me. Look, he uses five verbs to talk about what God did. He says, I waited patiently. He turned to me. He heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock, and fifth, he gave me a firm place to stand. So he picked me up out of the hole. He put me over here, gave me a firm place to stand. Now I'm on solid ground. With roughly 17% unemployment, counting the underemployment in our country right now, some of you guys feel like you're in a pit. Like, you know, there's no jobs available, you keep putting your resume out, you can't do anything, you feel like you're in a pit. Now, if tomorrow, clearly God provided you a job, you would feel like God picked you up out of that, set you on a firm place. Now I've got an income, solid support, I can pay my bills, I can feed my family. And so that's what David is describing here. Now David goes on to say, in verse 3, it says, he put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Now, what David is saying here is that by God delivering him, saving him out of this problem, God has actually given him a song to sing. And it's a new song. And what he's saying is that this experience has inspired me to begin to sing about God or to proclaim what God has done on my behalf. The whole Psalter, all these psalms, are the songs of experiences that people had where God stepped in and did something for them, and they wrote it out. Now, I don't know how many songwriters we have here, but one of the things that was common in the ancient world was that whenever God did something good for you, you would come up with a way to remember it. Abraham planted a tree. Joshua, when they crossed the Jordan, he set up these stones as stones of remembrance. David would write psalms or write songs. I mean, one of the things that would be great for you to consider is finding a way, whether through art, photography, journaling, I don't know, adding a room onto your house, I don't know, whatever your deal is, planting a tree, that you would do things that would be the reminder of God's activity on your behalf. And oftentimes I think our lives are diminished because we don't stop and make a big deal out of the really important, really cool things that God did. Wouldn't it be great if your great-grandkids someday could read the journal where you wrote down all these new songs or these new experiences of how God was faithful on your behalf? I mean, what a great legacy to pass on. So David's saying, he put a new song in my mouth. So what David has here in the first three verses is his personal experience of rescue. His personal experience of rescue. God has rescued him, and he's all excited about it. And his personal experience of rescue leads him to begin to reflect on God. And he tells us the lessons that he learned while he was reflecting on God in verses 4 and 5. So God rescued him, and then he learned some lessons from that. And look what he says. He says, "Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not look to the proud, who does not turn aside to false gods. Many, O Lord my God, are the wonders you have done, things you have planned for us. No one can recount to you, were I to speak and tell of them, they would be too many to declare." So he's thinking about, God, you saved me, and here's how you saved me. Now, as I put my new song down, I start taking a look at the big picture, and I'm starting to think, you know what? There are some lessons here. And the lesson is that the person who waits for you when they're in trouble, that's the person who's ultimately blessed. Not the person who turns to the proud or begins to crowd to false gods, who sells themselves to somebody else in order to get their problem solved, but the one who waits on you. And then he goes on to say, I love this, in verse 5, he says, "Many, O Lord, are my God, are the wonders you've done, things you planned for us. No one can recount to you, were I to speak and tell of them, they would be too many." So here's what David's thinking. Well, God, you got me out of this situation, and now I'm starting to think back over the course of my life. You know, there were a lot of times when I was in trouble. Well, what about the time when I was a kid, and you saved me there? And then when I was a teenager, and you saved me there? And when you know what? David comes to the understanding that God's got his whole life planned. God's been working through his whole life. These are not mere coincidences. There's too much to write down. And David begins to take a look at the big picture, and what he begins to do is understand that this problem that seemed like the beginning and the end of his world was only one example of how God demonstrated himself faithful. And some of you guys are in that situation. I mean, right now, you're in the middle of a relational crisis, and you feel like that's the beginning and the end of your world. Whatever takes place in this is going to define who I am. And you feel like, God, where are you? Where have you been? What are you doing here? And when God brings you through this and you get to the other side, you're going to take a step back and you're going to say, that's just one example of a myriad of examples that have come before and a myriad that will come after of how God has my life planned. And he's working in the ups and downs, the highs and lows, the good days and the bad days to bring about his will in my life. Now, when David gets to that point and realizes that it's God who's been working all along, it causes him to recommit himself to God. Notice in verses 6 through 8, David makes this decision to go all in. He makes this decision to go all in. God, if you're with me all the time, I'm going to totally commit to you. Look at verse 6. He says, "Sacrifice and offerings you did not desire, but my ears you have pierced. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, here I am, I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, O God. Your law is within my heart." Now, what is all that about? Well, he starts off and he tells what he's not interested in. And that is sacrifices and offerings you did not desire, burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Now, here's the problem. If you don't know somebody very well, and you're trying to get them to help you, what do you do? What do you do? You guys don't get a lot of help, do you? You bribe them, right? Hey, I need your help. You know, my car's making that noise. Yeah, you can help me out here. I'll take you out to dinner, right? You know, for a gift certificate, maybe you could put in a good word with your boss so I could get a job, or put in a good word with that girl, and I'll let you download some of my iTunes onto your little deal there. You know, what do? You pay people off, right? If you don't have a relationship with somebody and you want something from them, then you try to pay them off. That's kind of how life works. I'll give you something, you give me something. And that's the way a lot of us approach God. Because we don't know him very well, we think religious activity, like bringing offerings and sacrifices, now that's what God's really motivated by. Now, have you ever thought how silly that is? Okay, how much does God own of the money in the world? A lot of it, right? Some of it? More than the federal government? More than the Chinese government? He owns it all, right? He created it. It's all his. Oh, yeah, God, I'm going to put this $5 in the plate. And if I put this $5 in the plate here, you know what? I'm kind of expecting that I'm going to get the raise this week. Duh. We don't know God very well, do we? We think we know him, but we really don't. And a lot of us think that if we do religious activity, like if I show up, sing loud, stop, change the flat tire on the person on the side of the road, that God is going to be so overwhelmed. Never seen anything like this before. You just, like, I'm sitting there, you know, let's see. He gave me $1, $2, $3, $5. Whoa! That somehow God's going to say, okay, well, let me just jump right in there and get involved with you. It's not like that. See, the more you know about God, you know that God is not interested in what you give him. What God is interested in, whether you are personally committed to him, whether you personally are on the same page with him, whether you personally have given your life to him. And so here's what David says. David says, listen, you know, it's not about sacrifices. That's not what you want. You know what you want? You want me. And he starts out by saying, but my ears you have pierced. So if your child comes home, parents, and says, God pierced my ears. I don't know how that happened, but God pierced my ears. It's in the Bible. Psalm 40, he did it to David. He probably did it to me. This is more of a wax thing than it is a fashion thing. God, you pierced my ears. What David is saying is, while I was in the pit, and I'm down in this hole, and this experience of my life is weighing down heavily on me, and I'm calling out, hey, God, I need your help. I can't get out of this experience. I'm going to die down here. I need your help. Silence. God, where are you? I've waited patiently. When I get out of this, you know, I'm going to give you a cow. You know, I'll sacrifice it. You'll really want that, right? Silence. God, help me. Silence. What's happening? My ears are getting cleaned out. I'm listening very carefully now because there's nothing by way of noise. It's getting in my way. And then God reached in and grabbed David and lifted him out and set him on the solid rock. And it was clear that it was only God who could have done that. And David said, now you've got my attention. I'm listening. I'm listening. You got my attention. And David says, now that you've got my attention, verse 7, then I said, here I am. I have come. I'm here, God. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will. So in the Testaments, in the Old Testament writings, your will is written down. So I desire to do your will, oh my God. Your law is within my heart. In other words, God, I'm going to start being obedient to you. I'm going to obey you. I'm going to follow you. I am going to go all in. From now on, how I live is commitment to you. Now, I'm going to just do a quick time out here, because there's something that David has seen that motivates him to say this. Now, before I take you there, let me just say, one of the greatest sins that God has given us a process to get through it, to get past it, takes place between a parent and a child. Okay? God puts mom and dad in the life of a child so that a child can learn to deal with the greatest problem that they're going to have when they become an adult. And that is the problem of rebellion. So all of those bizarre and silly rules that mom and dad can come up with, dumb as they might be, are there to teach you how to be obedient to God. Let me show you how this works. Okay, so you're 15, and dad comes in and says, okay, son, here's what it's going to be. And you're listening to him talk, and you're thinking to yourself, Dad, this is not 1960. You've got to be kidding. You are so out of touch. Like, that may have been the way things should have been back when you were a kid, but today, like, it's 2010. People don't think that way. They don't act like that. That is so stupid. You know, Dad, you're just way out of it. And so I'm nodding, but I ain't going to do that. And here's your dad at age 50. He's opening up the Bible, and he's reading the Bible, and he looks up at his father, and he says, God, you've got to be kidding me. When was this thing written? Did you write this like 2,000 years ago? Because it's 2010. Nobody does business this way anymore. This is not the way. It won't work that way. Don't you understand modern marriage? Don't you understand modern economy? Are you thinking that I'm going to actually obey this? You've got to be kidding me. What's the difference? What's the difference? You see, if you can't submit, young adults, teenagers, if you can't submit to your parents, do you think that, like, all of a sudden later on, when God gives you a direction from His Word, that's going to all of a sudden make sense to you and you're going to always obey it? That doesn't work that way. And so what do we do? Yeah, well, let's try to buy them off. You know, we don't know our parents very well, so let's just try to buy them off. So, yeah, you're right, Mom, Dad, I didn't make curfew, and I'm with those people that you don't want me to be with, and I'm doing things you don't really want me to do, but I clean my room. Partial obedience? Well, I did, look. Or I'll be part of it. Now there's a sobering thing that happened just before David became king that made him well aware of this. And I want you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 15. We're going to look at a couple verses. This is one of the most challenging stories to me in all of the Old Testament. So keep your finger there in Psalm 40. We're going to come back. But I want you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16. Let me set this up for you. Basically, Saul's become king. And as king, he's going out now to defeat the enemies, and God's been blessing him and working with him. But Saul always has an agenda that's slightly different than God. And God sends, in chapter 15, God sends Saul on a very specific assignment. And here's the assignment. He says, there is a tribe of people that live in the community called the Amalekites. 400 years ago, I sent them word that their decadent lifestyle, and when I say decadent, I'm not talking about, you know, the guy down the street that drinks a little too much. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about child sacrifice. I'm talking about blood, just torturing their enemies. These people were so vile. And after 400 years of God sending messengers to them, God says, I'm done. So Saul, what I want you to do is I want you to go and destroy that civilization. I'm done with them. I want you to destroy it. But I don't want anybody on the outside to think that this was motivated by you wanting to conquer them so that you could get their stuff. In other words, this is a holy war. This is a judgment war. This isn't a war for you to benefit. And so what I want you to do is I want you to take all of their livestock and all of their gold and all of their clothes, and I want you to just pile it up and just eliminate it from the face of the earth. In other words, you went into battle completely and totally to bring judgment for the sin of this group of people. And so Saul does that. The only difference is Saul doesn't get rid of the animals. He keeps them. He doesn't get rid of the gold. He keeps it. In other words, he's thinking to himself, I did most of what God told me to do. And in the midst of that, Samuel the prophet and Saul come in to this conversation. And Samuel shows up and he sees all the animals around and he knows that Saul hasn't done what God told him to do. And here's the confrontation in verse 16. Saul is saying, you know, essentially I did what I was told. And Samuel says, stop, Samuel said to Saul. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Tell me, Saul replied. Samuel said, listen carefully, he says, although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission, saying, go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites, make war on them until you have wiped them out. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? Now listen to Saul. He says, but I did obey the Lord. I did obey the Lord. Now, how many times have you had that conversation with a son or daughter? You didn't do what I told you to do. Well, mom, dad, yeah, I did. Kind of. The way I interpret it, the way that makes sense to me. Men, how many times have you had that conversation with God? Well, God, I kind of did what your word told me to do. Kind of, mostly. Now look carefully at what he says. I went on the mission the Lord assigned to me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king, which would not be completely destroying them. The soldiers, they took the sheep and the cattle from the plunder and the best of what was devoted to God in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal. In other words, well, we took them, we did, but, you know, we're going to probably sacrifice some of them. Look what Samuel says. Samuel replied, does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Mom, but I did clean my room. Yeah, does the Lord delight in a payoff or in obedience? And then he says these very troubling words. He says, for rebellion is like the sin of divination and arrogance, like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. Here's what he's saying. He's saying, listen, when God gives us a directive and we choose to ignore it or go in a different direction, what we're doing is we're saying, I know better than God. I know more than God. God, you're outdated, you're ignorant, you're wrong. And that's exactly what the angel Lucifer did, who became Satan as he fell, because he stepped up and said, I will exalt myself above God. So, I mean, let's be really, really practical. When you look into the face of the authority in your life, whether it's your parents, whether it's your boss, whether it's God himself, and you say to him, I know better than you. Now, if they're commanding you to go cut somebody's wrist or, you know, we know better than that. Let's be real. I'm talking about when there's a reasonable, I shouldn't even say that because if you're 14, reasonable has a different definition. If there are real legitimate authorities in your life, okay, and you say no, what you're saying is, I'm above you. And that's a dangerous place to be. He compares it. He compares it to divination, to witchcraft, to idolatry. If you don't learn to be obedient, you will be a rebellious person against God. That doesn't change overnight. So David's thinking this. God, now that I know you, I know you don't want my stuff. You don't want religious lip service. What you want is you want my heart. You want my behavior. You want my lifestyle. You want, here's the cool thing about God, you want me. You don't want what I can bring you. You want a relationship with me. David gets that.
And so from his commitment, he is so turned on. I mean, so excited, so just enthused that he goes into this exclamation and he's got to talk about it. So we see the need to go public with it. Look at verses 9 and 10 back in Psalm 40. He says in Psalm 40, verses 9 and 10, I will proclaim righteousness in the great assembly. I do not seal my lips, as you know, O Lord. I do not hide your righteousness in my heart. Seal my lips, hide your righteousness in my heart. That's saying I'm not keeping it to myself. I will speak of your faithfulness and salvation. I do not conceal your love and your truth from the great assembly. The great assembly would be when the people gathered in the temple. So it would be like coming to a worship service and saying, I got to say stuff to people. You know, I got to open my mouth. I got to tell people, God is incredible. When I think about what he's done for me, I see his righteousness. I see his salvation. I see his faithfulness. I see his love. I see all these characteristics about God, and I just can't help it. I got to talk about it. I got to tell people. It's got to roll out of my mouth. I'm not going to hide it. Waiting rewarded. And then the psalm turns and goes really downhill. Evidently, David then runs into another crisis, a crisis of his making. So in verses 11 and following, we see that in connecting with God, we'll also experience times of waiting renewed. Waiting renewed. He's back into waiting again. And notice he says that my sin has undermined my very life. Verses 11 and 12, my sin has undermined my very life. He says, do not withhold your mercy from me, O Lord. May your love and your truth always protect me. For troubles without number have surrounded me. My sins have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head, and my heart fails within me. David says, you know what? Like, while I'm praising you, while I'm making a commitment to serve you, I mess up. Like, now I've done something wrong, and I'm appealing to your mercy to help me because I'm not perfect. I mess up in this relationship. And David says, because I've messed up, now I'm back in the pit again. And we don't know what he did. We don't know what the sin is. But if you read the life of David, you know he committed a bunch of them, right? He committed the big ones, didn't he? And just because David had reached a point where he was walking on the mountaintop with God and praising him, that didn't guarantee that he wouldn't be tempted and he wouldn't fall. And he's fallen again. And he's saying, I am so depressed. Like, when I think about it, it's like the number of hairs on my head. And most of those Jewish guys had some pretty full heads of hair. And he's saying, I'm just wiped out. My heart is heavy within me. I'm just absolutely wiped out. Now, here's one of the ways that you know God. You know God, not by being perfect, that you never sin, but by when you sin, you feel it. When you sin, you feel it. There's a part of you that's broken. Now, I know some people, like you may be here today and you may be saying, well, I'm doing some sin right now and I'm having a blast with it. Like, I'm just enjoying it. I mean, I'm at the happiest time of my life. I'm way out there doing things I shouldn't be doing and I'm having a blast doing it. What I would say to you, is that's a strong indication that your relationship with God is very shaky. You don't really know God if you can do things that damage you, who he loves, and damage your relationship with him and damage other people, and it not bother you. David is bothered by this. In addition to that, David has consequences. In fact, he calls them his enemies in verses 13 through 15. He says that my enemies that grow because of my failures. In other words, the sin produces consequences. In verse 13, he says, be pleased, O Lord, to save me. O Lord, come quickly to help me. May all who seek to take my life be put to shame and confusion. May all who desire my ruin be turned back in disgrace. May those who say to me, aha, aha, look at you, you messed up, buddy, aha, aha, may they be appalled at their own shame. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your salvation always say, the Lord be exalted. There are lots of things that we do that bring consequences into our lives. And when we do those things, the goal is not to be mad at the consequences. The goal is to focus on the one who saves. He says, those who rejoice in your salvation, may they be the ones who do well. And then he ends with this last verse. He says, yet I am poor and needy. May the Lord think of me. You are my help and my deliverer, O God, Do not delay. Now he's back to the same place he was when he started. God, I need your help, and I know your help will come in time. I know your help will come. It's going to come in time, but do not delay, because I need your help. From the pit, valley, to the mountaintop, back down to the pit, praying, waiting for the mountaintop. Okay, now we've looked at Psalm 40, and I want to pause and take a little bit deeper look for just a moment. Now, as we do this, how many of you here have ever written a poem? Okay, some of you are lying, because in fifth grade, you study iambic pentameter and all that stuff, haiku, you had to write something. Some of you might be songwriters. Now you know that part of the art or part of the beauty is not simply in the words themselves that you choose, but in the way that you put the words together, the structure. And this psalm has a very clear structure. It's called a chiasm. And in a chiasm, that means the first idea and the last idea are parallel, and then the middle ideas become parallel all the way down to the very center of the psalm. Let me show you what that looks like here. I'm going to put it up here for you. You see, the first three verses, David talks about salvation and how he was saved from the pit. In the last, he talks about his need for salvation. God, do not delay. Come and save me. And then in verses 4 and 5, he talks about the blessedness of God's protection. And in verses 13 through 16, he's praying for God's protection. God, help me from my enemies. And then in the next little section, 6 through 8, he gives his expression of commitment. God, I'm going to obey you. I'm not just going to sacrifice. I'm going to obey you. But in verse 12, he admits, I've fallen again, confession of sin. I said I was going to do it, but I can't do it. I've fallen again. Now, right in the middle, proclamation of God's perfections and prayer for God's perfections. In the psalm, the way it is written, it's designed to point you to that as the primary focus. God's righteousness, his faithfulness, his salvation, his love, his truth, and his mercies. There's six characteristics of God's relationship with David. And here's how the psalm is designed. That when everything is going good, verses 9 and 10, when David is on the mountaintop, what's it all about? It's about who God is, God's perfection, God's relationship with David. When David is down in the valley, what's it all about? It's all about God's relationship with David. Okay? So here's how this works. Life's going along great. I'm on the mountaintop. What do I do when I get on the mountaintop? I look at the view. Hey, God, my job is paying the bills. In fact, I've got extra. Isn't this nice? My family's doing well. I got a new car. My 401k's going off the roof. My golf score's getting better. Like, I can really hit the ball further than I ever have. My life is wonderful. Look at my health. What happens on the mountaintop is we tend to take our eyes off of God and look at the blessings that we have and think it's all about us. And then we travel down in the valley. Unemployment. She walks out on you. Relationships are falling apart. Your health is going bad. And what do we tend to do down in the valley? Oh, man, I hurt so bad. Everything's falling apart. I can't pay the bills. Nobody likes me anymore. And it's all about who? It's all about me. Okay? Peter. He's sitting in the boat. The waves are crashing all over the place, and all of a sudden he sees Jesus walking on the water. And what does he do? He says, hey, Jesus, I want to do that. Can I do that? And Jesus says, come on. I'm always thinking under his breath, he's saying, come on, you idiot, but come on, Peter. So Peter steps out of the boat. He's looking at Jesus. This is about Jesus. And he starts to walk on the water, and then all of a sudden he realizes, hey, I'm walking on water. Look at this. Cool. And he takes his eyes off of Jesus and starts putting it on how cool it is to walk on the water. And what begins to happen? He sinks into the depths. He goes from the heights to the depths. And then he's in the water and he's thinking, I'm going to drown, I'm going to drown. The waves are killing me, I'm going to drown here. And it's not until he sees Jesus again, he reaches his hand up and takes his hand of Jesus, and Jesus pulls him up. And what God is doing in your life right now, whether you see it or whether you don't, is God is taking you through the experiences of life that sometimes take you up on the mountain, sometimes take you down into the valley, to show you that what really matters is not the height of heights and how good everything is and it's all wonderful and everything's coming my way and I'm having fun, or how bad everything is and it's all falling apart and I just can't keep going. But you know what? Having God on the mountaintop and having God in the valley is what life is all about. And let me say this and see if it's possible that we can get this. And when I say that, I keep forgetting this. So I'm saying it so we'll remember it. A lot of times we think this life is about making money and having friends and having fun. That's what we really think this life is about. And we think that the goal of this life is not to get into a position where things are hard, where they hurt, where I have to do things I don't want to do, where I'm struggling physically. And we think that that's what life is not about. And if I can somehow keep these experiences flowing, where I got a lot of jack coming in, I'm enjoying a lot of things, people are liking me, I got a lot going on in my life, then that's really life. And someday, I'm going to die. And then we'll have anything except Jesus. And hopefully that will be good. But I'll wait. Because right now, life is really about stuff, about fun, about love, people connecting with me, people thinking I'm something. You know what? The longer we walk and live that life, the more bored, depressed, frustrated, angry, given over to addiction. I mean, the more we travel a path that we were not designed to travel, because we were designed for a relationship with God. That's what we were designed for. And to know God and to experience Him, that is what makes this life and the life to come rich, full, real. What David is saying in Psalm 40 is whether I'm on the top or whether I'm down in the bottom, it's knowing Jesus. It's being connected to God. It's living my life with Him. That's what makes this life real, good, meaningful. Now, the reason why I ask you guys to pray before we started that God would speak to you, it's because, let's just face it, most of us, and get me to the mountaintop and I'll have a great time up there. And we're not looking for this. We're looking for life to make sense on our terms that make us comfortable, enjoyable, and easy. And we're missing out on real life. Now, it's not going to be a sermon that opens your mind to that. It's only going to be a supernatural work of God speaking deeply into your heart, drawing from that longing, that connecting with the God of the universe, the God of heaven, the God of history, the God of truth is all that will ever satisfy this soul. Let's bow our heads together. I want you to go back for a moment to that prayer that you prayed at the beginning of the service. I want you to ask the question, God, what did you say to me today? What did you say? What is it that you spoke to me? What have you been telling me? What do I need to hear? If you hear that,